I'm going to. Okay? So, because there's nothing worse than dead silence. Even stem cells cannot restore that situation. I first ask if there are some, I have some of my own, but I'd like to hear if you have any from the audience, and we can chime in, okay? I hear moribund silence. Yes.
Yeah.
I have a question for Claudia. So much of your job is you're on the phone talking to scientists trying to find out information. In general, are you well received? Are scientists eager to talk with you, or do they get nervous? Oh no, it's the press, it's the media.
I think in general, yes. It varies story to story. And I was telling the science writing students earlier that some scientists are sort of mini celebrities because they're on stem cells. They're certain well-known scientists, and they become known, and they're more used to talking to the media. And there are definitely plenty who are skeptical, and I understand that. I think that there's been plenty of science writing that is inaccurate, that is hyped, that creates, false expectations. And so there's a lot of concern about getting it wrong. I also told the question came up earlier from the students, do you check back with the scientists? And I make a real point of doing that because you don't often do that with other beats in the media. You wouldn't call up a politician and say, did you really say this? But for science, it's irresponsible to get it wrong, and the impact is enormous. So I do try to, even on deadline, carve out the time to check.
Dick.
If you listen to the arguments and read the news reports, you would get the impression that stem cell research and stem cell controversy is almost a solely American phenomenon, like real football. What happens if you look across the world and look at what kind of technologies other countries are considered, what kind of ethical constraints other societies have, what kinds of businesses other countries are setting up to take advantage of stem cell research? What kind of thing do we see if we look at it in a more international perspective?
Rudolph.
Well, I mean, I can give you some examples. I mean, I think there's no unifying politics. So if you go, let's say, what I know particularly well is Germany. It's extremely restrictive. It is crazy. It's even worse than here. Because in Germany, the typical German way of doing it, they immediately make a law. In America, the Congress couldn't come to any agreement. There's no law. So no law, you don't need much of a majority to change a no law, right? It's legal here. You just can't get federal funds. In Germany, it's criminal. And there's a law. And you can't change laws. That's very difficult. So that is much worse. And you go to Italy, it's the same. You go to another Catholic country like Spain, it's one of the most liberal ones. The Catholic Church is mad. But they're really passed no laws, but it's very, very liberal. So the countries who, I think, do it in a good way, copy the way the British did. The British really led the way how you should go through the process by public debate and come to a reasonable, well thought through policy, where you argue that, and I think that's a key thing of the British law, that the question is when does life begin is not really the relevant question. I mean, as a biologist, you would say it begins with fertilization. I can't do anything else, but this is not the issue. The issue is when does an embryo deserve protection like a person. That's the issue. So when is it? Is it fertilization? And the Catholic Church, I think, the soul comes in with the sperm, so that would be then already. Or is it at the blastocyst stage, before the implants, or after implantation, or when you get a spinal cord, or when you get a primitive streak, or at birth, or whatever, right? So this is really scientifically not to decide. You can't decide this. So what they said is, well, we make a compromise. We say as long as the embryo hasn't implanted, it could be used for research. Once it's implanted, you absolutely would be criminal to to make experiments. So under certain conditions, that was a process really, which was, I think, was very important, the process they did. They came to the conclusion, yes, you can manipulate the non-implanted embryo under certain conditions. So it's not a time frame. They don't say you can do it up to 7 days or 10 days. That's dangerous because it's a slippery slope. Because if it works for 10 days, not well, you go to 15 days, you go on and on, and you eventually end up with an advanced embryo. They say implantation. Non-implanted, you can do it. Implanted, you cannot. That's a black and white. It's not a slippery slope. So many countries followed that, but others did not. And in the U.S., there was no agreement, so there's no law.
Asian countries are, in general, fairly liberal with allowing stem cell research, even though there are substantial Catholic populations. In Israel, stem cell research is a very positive environment for embryonic stem cell research. And there are biblical scholars in days past who've likened the status of the unborn embryo, so prior to birth, as no more than the status of a couple of drops of water. I'm not saying that anybody believes that today, but the Bible isn't, Old and New Testaments are certainly not homogeneous on this, and even the Catholic Church, you'll remember back prior to the around 1800, and a group of scientists that the church pulled together then thought that the sperm contained a little man, remember? And that the woman's body was just an incubator. The woman's participation was just as an incubator. And it was only after that conclave, upon their recommendation, that fertilization was decided to be the start of life.
I think I saw another hand. No? Perhaps it was a foot. You know, I mean, I forget the exact quote from Winston Churchill, but Americans always get it right after trying all the wrong options. I have a question so there are two that are sort of on the, one is the Geron thing, which I think we should at least discuss, and maybe we could discuss that first, and then I have one of my own. Do either of the scientists have some comment?
Well, the Geron trial, if you talk with experts, and I've done, I consider myself, they're very doubtful about the scientific basis of that. So Geron pushes that, and I have very cold feet. It could really go wrong, because the scientific basis for this result is really not established. And these rats of Hans Kerstedt, I don't know. I don't want to talk about them. So this is a problem, I think. So these things can go wrong. The paradigm for this is the gene therapy in the 90s, which went terribly wrong. It was totally oversold and was then used in irresponsible way in a university setting in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Can I just interest you? So in the 90s, a great hope that you might have seen, I don't know that it was in Newsweek, probably, sure I'd say it was in Time, how's that? that you could do gene therapy for an immune disease by taking a retrovirus and basically correcting the defect by putting the virus in.
Right. So this was, many people did this, and there were trials, and the retrovirus, of course, have the potential to make cancer. In the trial, they used then different vectors. They used adenovirus vectors for this famous... that was a young adult, 21 years old student, I think, even wasn't life-threatening sick. He was treatable. And he was treated by this group in Pennsylvania with adenovirus vectors. And although the monkey trials had raised some red flags that it went anyway. And the immune reaction against the adenovirus was so fulminant that he died of multiple organ failure. So this was a major problem for all gene therapy trials. And the field really has slowly begun to recover from this, and some trials are ongoing. But so this is the problem. When you go into the field, and I would think, so I worry about the Geron trials.
It's an interesting area, though. If you go back in cancer chemotherapy, and you go back to the 1940s and early 1950s, the decisions to give people very dangerous drugs, drugs derived essentially from nitrogen mustard, based on the World War I battlefield experience, that eventually are now used as part of curative therapies, drugs that hadn't been used in people before and only had animal evidence behind them, are now mainstays in curative therapy for leukemias in children. These drugs were used and had massive side effects, horrible side effects, in a lot of the adults and children who were treated. Yet the studies were done in patients who otherwise had literally weeks to live, and these patients said they wanted to do it. So we could have a room, and probably Claudia, and I know Rudy and I have been in rooms where you might have 100 people with spinal cord injuries and paralysis, and 50 of them would say, I want to do the Geron trial tomorrow, and I want to do the most radical stuff you can think of if you tell me A, that it's safe, or pretty safe, and B, that it has some chance of helping me because my life is terrible. And the other 50 would say, you know, we don't want to spoil this. We want more studies in animals. We'd like to have a stem cell therapy that really grew neurons, not one that just rescued the endogenous neurons or did some, we were talking at our table about a hit drug mechanism proposed where they provided some trophic factors theoretically, but there was very little evidence for this, and you'd get that divided population. If there is that divided population, and if there are patients who very much want to do this, and think back to the days of the early HIV trials, in addition to the early cancer trials, where patients with HIV were really making movies in the press and pounding on the doors to get these medicines early before their toxicity had been fully evaluated. Now, OSL is different, but it's humbling to think you know the answer and then see this audience split 50-50 like this. And Claudia, how do you look?
Well, it's interesting because I know the FDA went back and forth a little bit about with asking for more information, and I know from talking to scientists they're concerned that there's not enough public material available to read about Geron's work, so people are having trouble really judging it, and also just because it's the first, it has such a heavy weight on it, because if it does fail, or if some in the safety trial, if something terrible happens, the media will seize it, and what will that mean for the field? Again, well, you know, your cycle of whatever that hype thing,
the Gartner cycle,
you know, could be a real terrible moment, and maybe not, you know, maybe unfortunately the wrong case in terms of the first trial. But is any? I mean, I guess I'm curious about why do you think they got to the point of the FDA saying, okay, go ahead and do it, if there are all these concerns about whether it's premature?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I think the point is, yes, the FDA says, well, these bad guys, they prevent these innovative trials. But there's a need for that. I mean, when you think about, I mean, you talked about the stem cell tourism. This is such a big concern. And now, these extreme cases like what you quoted and so on, yes, so they should be criminalized. But then you have, based on just faulty scientific evidence, people inject bone marrow-derived cells into heart patients. And they do this in clinics in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to my opinion, this is just outrageous. There's zero scientific evidence for this being helpful. And they're doing this, and I think those things are very concerning, and they should be, to my opinion, regulated. Although I realize that these people are desperate because they have this condition and they would die, and the doctors really want to help them. But this alone is not sufficient to do that. You need a little bit more.
Mm. There's a question in the back here.
Yeah, it seems like the consensus amongst the panelists is that Geron's like kind of in the business of rushing their operation, and some of their studies seem a bit premature. I do know that Geron is a public company with, you know, that anyone can really buy an investment share, and so like for $5 a share really. So with the fact that the company's public and that a lot of their capital is depending on their image to the public, like where their advancements, when advancements are being made, and I guess the fashion is, would that, is that what we want to subject science to? Should, is that partially, could Geron's like behavior partially be attributed to that?
Can I take a try at that, spreading it a little more broadly than Geron? A number of people on the panel have observed the fact that almost all the funding for fundamental research comes from the federal government. Other than Geron, there isn't any work being, well, there's a lot of work being done very quietly, but not with a lot of expenditure of capital, which would be very welcome in theory. So I completely agree with Dr. Janisch that this is a very high-risk proposition. The theory may be right, just as the theory was right in gene therapy, and it was the vector that killed the patient. It wasn't the the fundamental theory. Raising capital for this kind of work from the private sector by investing in Geron at $5 a share or any number of other companies that we could discuss would be a social good, because it would increase the amount of research that could be brought to bear and will advance the possibility of bringing therapies based on that research into the clinic, which in this case is not taking place yet other than in this one trial. It's confronted with several issues. The question of the FDA was raised a moment ago. It is certainly countercultural of the FDA at the moment to have approved that trial because they've become increasingly conservative. We regularly see them turn down new technologies almost when they are simultaneously being approved by the European Medicines Authority, who are more conservative than some of the folks you mentioned in Germany. The other issue that is confronting capital formation to support this kind of work is the PTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, who have become under increasing pressure not to grant intellectual property over technologies which are considered to be basic functions of the human body that are have a degree of obviousness to them and have become politically viewed as being in some fashion sacrosanct from commercial development. One example, of course, is what was done with the work in the Human Genome Project when it was put into the public domain, which it largely was. There was a private company that tried to privatize it, well known to Jerry and his colleagues at the Whitehead Institute, not well or not popularly. But in the absence of intellectual property backing up these kind of discoveries and approval from the FDA to take some chances, which they've certainly done in a big way on this one, the high risk of this one, which I think is reflected in what everyone has said, is that if it goes bad, it can set this technology back for quite a long time. This is a big deal.
I was going to ask a question more on the science side. We saw that video of the cardiac cells beating in vitro, which is amazing in and of itself. But one of the holy grails of stem cell research is eventually to be able to grow organs and transplant them into humans without them being rejected, which just seems so impossible to me at this point, to be able to get the right morphology and have a heart with the right pumping mechanisms, the aorta, et cetera. What are sort of the prospects for that? And number two, you were also talking about applying the right factors to even get the proper kind of a cell to develop or differentiate. What are some of the factors that you can apply to make a stem cell become a functional organ?
Let me just first clarify something. I don't think the goal is to grow organs. You cannot grow a heart. You cannot grow a kidney. This need embryonic inductions can only occur in the embryo. So the only thing you can make heart cells, kidney cells, or nerve cells, but not the brain. So this is not the goal. You have to learn that, and this being learned by good embryologists, knowing what are the key factors to make out of a precursor cell a heart cell. Following this logic, you put this in the culture dish, people have been successful. And heart cells is actually pretty straightforward. It's one of the easier ones. So some other cell types are much more difficult. So what you can do when you come to organs, what people have done very successfully, is, for example, that was a very really interesting experiment. There were people who lost, for accident by acid or something, their esophagus,
mm-hmm.
right? So you cannot make an esophagus in the culture dish, but we can make the cells which line the esophagus. So what they did is they took from cadavers an esophagus and totally decellularized it. So what's left over was only the extracellular matrix, which of course is where the cell, and they seeded cells on those. And these cells then generated the right surface epithelium and other cell types, which then they could put and stitch back into the patient. So this is a type of, I wouldn't call it organogenesis, but it's bioengineering. So it's bioengineering of sort of simple tissues like an esophagus or a bladder. Bladder is also something that you can do it this way. People are doing that. But for many applications, you don't need the organ. You need liver cells. They're fine. You put them into the hepatic vein and they find their way. You need beta cells you don't need a pancreas. You need beta cells that can function in the cell and stuff like that. And for heart, it might be more difficult, or blood cells, so they find their way, as we heard, right? So it depends on the organ you want to treat.
But just for example, in the heart, those cells that you see in the dish beat much more slowly than your heart beats. If you implanted those cells in the heart, and if they formed a clone, they would presumably generate an arrhythmia, which would give you kind of a heart attack.
Or at least AFib.
So I have a question which I think I have a feeling they involve everyone, but how often do your editors, how much pressure is you for your editors to give a balanced story? Give both sides. And the reason I put it that way is frequently, as a scientist, I know that 99.9% of the scientists think that it's not 50-50, and that the other 50%, you'll excuse the expression, is nonsense. Okay, and yet you read, and I don't mean you in particular, but I'm curious about the process, which is how much pressure on you is there to give a balanced story, rather than you say, but you know, I've talked to 10 scientists and, you know, the only one is this lunatic, okay, at Williams College who thinks that.
Well, it's a great question at a really interesting moment because things are changing so much in journalism right now. And this is something also I talked with science writing students earlier about, is that I think there used to be actually much more pressure to be objective and to give equal time to make sure you had two sides and to give equal time. But with the advent of the web and blogging and social media and the increased numbers of people voicing opinions in whatever the topic is, journalism, the focus now is more on not necessarily taking a stand, but having a voice on a story, more than it was in the past, even on a science story. I think the challenge for journalists, especially for journalists who are not covering a beat full-time, and that's something that I struggle with, and who are not trained in science and able to take science classes consistently enough to be up on the science, is always being able to determine what is hogwash and what is just a different opinion, and how do I know when this scientist critiques that scientist that guy's really wrong, or maybe they're just fighting for that federal fund that they want. And it's very hard as the reporter to always really know the truth of the matter about which side is right and which side is wrong. And of course, you want to be balanced and objective, and it's not. If you're writing an editorial, that's one thing, but if you're writing a story, you want to be able to present all sides. But I think there's actually a movement now more toward shaping the story in a way that may be more pleasing to what you're talking about.
Well, the reason I started my comments when I introduced Rudolph by saying what we do, so what do scientists do, right? You know, we read the journals, we see all these things, but you know, there are people. We know, I don't know how to say it in any other way, we know who the fakers are. Okay. And so, you know, if I want to know about something in stem cell research, I go and talk to Rudolph, and he says, did you really read the paper? And I say, no, I just glanced at the abstract and, you know, read through the thing. He said, read it carefully. It's, you know, BS. Okay. Or, you know, you should read this. Okay. And so I would say that there are people, you have to have a cadre of people who you know are knowers.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, for reporters, the most important thing a scientist can do is be willing to talk off the record, to trust the reporter enough to say to them, here's what's wrong with this guy's research, instead of saying, you know, I don't want to talk about that guy. Don't ask me about his research. If I don't understand what the problem is, then it may be hard for me to digest the information and report it appropriately. So what scientists, the best conversations I will have with scientists are off-the-record conversations where they're willing to trust me enough to know I'm not going to use it in the story, but I'm going to use it to understand the story.
I was talking to listening to a group of science writers at a conference, and they were talking about the difficulties in being science writers. I don't know if you'd agree with this, but they were talking about the sports writers. And a sports writer, if he covers in the U.S. Baseball, football, basketball, maybe on some weeks has to cover tennis or track or something like that. But a science writer often has to cover business also, and just the diversity of science that you have to cover, where you don't have your own knowledge and you're solely at the liberty of who is explaining it in a way that it sounds good to you, and it's a frightening thing that they would you care to dilate on?
Yeah, no, it's very scary because, you know, as I mentioned, the cycle can be very quick, and to be able to, first you have to get people on the phone or willing to respond to the phone call, then you have to have the conversation, and then there's so little time to digest the information, There's also not, I mean, one of my frustrations is there's not a lot of feedback once the stories come out. So I am greatly appreciative of somebody who calls up and says, you know, that wasn't quite right and I'll tell you why, or, you know, you might want to think about doing this or that. I mean, I realize people are busy and they don't have time to necessarily respond, but the more dialogue, the better. But the challenge of, I think about this a lot with my colleagues, because the challenge of understanding science and reporting it responsibly, and you have to translate it into simple enough language that people can understand, is huge and complex. And, you know, in a perfect world, you know, if you want to give a sports writer 2 days to write a story, that's great. But I would love a month, you know, but I don't get it because I need, it's hard. It's hard stuff to understand, and it's hard not only on the scientific level, but on the broader level of politics and business and all the other pieces that play into it. So the challenge makes it such an exciting job and such an incredibly vivid learning experience, but also daunting.
Could the scientists on the panel comment then? So you spent a lot of time making sure you get your story right. Professor Fink mentioned that people know who the trustworthy sources are and who aren't. So how does something like Korean research get published in prominent journals then if you know who? So if you could just comment on how that happens and sort of the politics of publication and these esteemed journals.
That's a great question.
God. That's a complicated question.
That's a great question.
So the paper in Science, some of the images came from a journal which called Stem Cells, which I edited at that time. And so several issues were raised for us, which was, okay, the paper that paper came from, what should we do with that? And we went through a whole lot of stuff. And the paper in Science had 16 authors. Please forgive me if I say this wrong. But they all had similar names. And then the paper in the journal Stem Cells had 16 authors, all with very similar names. So if we decide we're going to embargo those scientists next week or next year or for a while from having papers published in our journal, how do we make sure we've got the right person we're embargoing? And what if it's another paper with 16 names and that person? And we did a little bit. But the question you ask is how will we, why didn't we know that those people were not to be trusted? And that group was really instrumental in cloning, doing SCNT, cloning, reproductive cloning, in several other species, including dog, including, and this work has been verified to this day. I went over to a meeting not much before that, and it was a stem cell meeting they sponsored. This guy was, Huang was being made, what was he, the presidential scientist, supreme scientist of Korea.
Treasure.
Every other scientist in Korea was angry and jealous because they tithed everybody's money to support his work. And he was, it was a big group and there were serious people, it looked like, who were working hard on this problem and having success in other areas. So it wasn't implausible that they had succeeded, and it was very just carefully fabricated, and our protections against lying take a while because they demand reproduction of the data, and that's what disproved this. Nobody else could do it.
Well, this is it's also a cultural difference. The cultural difference is that, I mean, I know this. I know the guy. I know the paper very well. I have looked very carefully at this. I don't want to go into this. But the point was, questions were raised in Wang's lab by people, there's something wrong. And these people were threatened. They were thrown out of the lab. They were threatened. They're people from the outside, particularly a TV station, was alerted to this. And they got death threats because they're questioning one of the treasures of Korea, and it only that they, I think, illegally obtained a DNA sample and then sequenced themselves, and it was clear that it was fraudulent, and then comes all these figures were used twice. So the question is, what failed there? So one thing failed: if someone at MIT raises a question about the correctness of data, which has happened, of a faculty member. This person was relieved of his job the same evening. So it was long, it was then the investigation came and it turned out to be fraud. So the reaction was very swift to a whistleblowing event. And in Korea, it was dangerous. Right, so this TV station almost went out of business because all the advertisements went away. But then eventually it was a bigger scandal. So I think there's a cultural difference to between how the ethics of science is taught here and practiced here in most cases, as it's in many cases practiced there. I mean, I know many more examples of this sort, where this blatant fraud. That was blatant fraud.
So I think your question
was different from
the. I think it was a little broader than that. I can't help recollect the science nature issue over the Human Genome Project, because pressure can be brought on journals as well as to what they should or should not publish. And as you all, I think everyone here knows, there was a publicly funded project to sequence the human genome, which was the work of many years. And a private company was formed by an entrepreneur named Craig Venter, who developed a new method of sequencing, which was widely poo-pooed by the scientific community, but turned out to work better than people thought it would. It did not produce a complete sequence, but it produced a, some would say, respectable sequence. So under pressure of both the U.S. and British governments, a tie was declared, and Francis Collins and Craig Venter shook hands at the White House. So it then came time to publish these results, and the public project was published in Nature. And Science, the other principal scientific publication, chose to publish the Venter sequence. Enormous pressure was brought on Science not to publish it, in part led by a colleague and classmate, Harold Varmus, who preceded us both here by 1 year. They both grew up in the same town, incidentally, so there's something very good in the water in Freeport, Long Island. there was a great deal of pressure brought on Science not to publish Venter's results, even though they were not completely unrespected.
But let me try to focus a little bit on what I see here. I didn't want my introductory
remarks
to let you think that, you know, even in the very best labs, there aren't experiments published which have problems in their interpretation. Okay, so in the very best labs, that happens. But in science, as you heard, if they're not repeatable and people can't repeat them, okay, then, you know, people find there are flaws in experiments and so on and so forth that people didn't foresee. And that's how science works. I mean, you know, you build on your own mistakes and the mistakes of others and try to do it. So it's not like there's some absolute truth but fraud is something different. Okay. Fraud is, it's like someone said, what's the difference between plagiarism and fraud? Okay, in plagiarism, okay, you represent somebody else's work as your own. And fraudery is vice versa, right? Okay, and so, you know, fraud is really when you try to deceive people. But people make mistakes all the time, okay? They make mistakes, or the technology wasn't equal to the problem. I mean, you know, we all face these issues and so on. But I think what Rudolf said is really true. We had, just as a mea culpa, we had a case at MIT where students in a laboratory said that, that they didn't believe that the data that was published, and it was a very high visibility situation.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And I think within 24 hours, I mean, you know, this guy was basically, I don't know, what do they do in the police department? There's a word for it. When you, you know, you shoot someone and then they want to make sure you did it on the job.
Suspend.
Pardon?
No, they suspended him.
Incarcerate?
No. They put you on indefinite leave or something. Yeah. Like that.
Ah.
Yes, that's true.
Oh, yeah.
There's
I see.
Word
yeah.
for it. At any rate, you know, there's a way of dealing with it, and we have a way in science, and even in the stem cell field right now, I would say at our sister institution, there's a big case right now of some concern to the scientific community and so on. If someone was a highly regarded young scientist, and so, you know, it happens. It's not clear that that those were fraud. There are cases, you know, so I think the difficulty for, I don't mean to represent it, is, you know, it's the process of science. Things aren't always right, even when you think they're right. And the scientists think they're right. And so getting to the bottom of it, if you only have 24 hours, is not that easy.
So usually what happens when there's a paper that we think is, or somebody in my lab thinks is quite important in our field, is we flag that for a journal club. And then in the journal club, somebody presents that, we all read it before, and we talk about that for maybe an hour or so. And usually we find a lot of things that we wish had been done, and we figure will be done over time, and we'll really know the answer. And so we say, often, you know, I hope this is true. I hope this turns out this way, or we should do this to test this further if we're really interested in it, or actually outright repeat it if we're really interested in it. So the trouble is that the reporter, not Claudia, but the reporter from Time, the Williams Educated Reporter from Time, calls us, and says, here's this paper that's going to be published next week, and here's the title, and it's from this lab. What do you think? And, gee, I'd like to read more than the title. I know what this lab does, but I really know what they say in the paper. Oh, we'll email it to you. Can you respond in 36 minutes when my deadline? Well, no, I can't convene the journal club of 22 people and really think about this in a considered way. So I can make some sort of statement to give background and some sort of statement saying, maybe I hope this will be true, and I hope that the following experiments either were done here or will be done in the future on it. But that's the real test. And I don't know, no matter what we thought about the Korean experiment, whether we like the guy or not, whether we like the hierarchical system of science or not, I don't either. But the real test was nobody else could do it after sufficient time to go over there and learn the difficult technique.
And actually, I thought your question was politics of publication, which is a very complex issue. So what determines whether you're published in a so-called high-impact journal like Science or Nature or Cell, or something like maybe foundation and association-driven journal, which is different? And I think that's the result of politics there. So how is it decided? I think that's interesting. Journals have different policies. So there's a chief editor and editorial board, and they see and they come in. They look at this now. Does it have newsworthiness? I think it goes into that. So they're pushing often, particularly in a fast-moving field like stem cells. It's very rapidly moving. They're pushing things in against the advice of the reviewers. Now, I have kind of this really very high-profile case, which is total nonsense. Right? But it was very newsworthy, right? Got published in Cell or in these. So you get very often pushed for these reasons in these so-called high-impact journals. Papers we shouldn't be, they're premature, or they maybe have flaws, which really my colleague Bob Weinberg then says, well, it was published in Nature, it still might be right. So it's not necessarily a sign of quality, but it's really a consequence of much of this very complex politics just ongoing.
That's what I was trying to
say. So another thing to say, though, is I have criticized and at the extreme asked for a strong revision of papers of really fine scientists who are close friends. So one of the really good parts of science is that there is this community of people. You know, we're talking about fraud and all these other things, but the bulk of science isn't that. Okay, the bulk of science is people trying to get at the quote little t truth. Okay, and you know, I mean, I won't mention the names of the people whose papers I had rejected, or criticized severely. In fact, one of my own postdocs, who's a professor at Princeton now, was a reviewer of one of my papers, and you know, he called me up and he said, "I just don't, you know, why didn't you do this experiment? Why didn't you do that experiment?" And so on. I said, "Oh, you were the reviewer who did this." And so I think it would be wrong to, misrepresenting the fields that we're talking about as, you know, populated by people who, one, are looking only for, you know, to have a company go forward, or two, to, you know, put something over on people so they get ahead and so on. In general, you know, there's really good criticism of papers, and the feedback is also often extremely useful, okay, both to us and to our students. And so I felt obliged to say that. It's just that the process, you know, you've got to really, you think you've cured spinal cord injury. What do? You know, you didn't do all the experiments. You did 90% of them. Okay, and, you know, should you keep it quiet until you get it 100%? You know, there are decisions to be made when you make these papers. Yeah. Now, people have a track record, okay? So by the time you're in science for a while, you know, if you, you know, someone said to me, you know, well, you know, 10% of this guy's papers are not right. Well, that doesn't sound good, okay? You know, I said, would you accept it at the 50% level? You know, I mean, where's the cutoff on those things? So in general, I mean, people, you know, are trying to get it out, and they believe they're moving the field forward, but people make mistakes.
There's also, I mean, one of the things we deal with is the embargo system, which I think plays a big role, because we get the press release saying this is coming out next week or tomorrow or whatever the date is, and the idea is that everybody gets, you know, the chance to break the news at the same time, and you're supposed to get this advance time to report it out and call you and say, can you look at this, and which is good, but it also creates this sort of competitive thing in the media of, you know, well, he's going to have it on Monday at 10 a.m. and so I need to too. So there's a lot of debate over whether the embargo system makes sense, but I think to some degree it increases the pressure and maybe contributes to some of this stuff that maybe shouldn't be reported on that is.
I have a story in a different direction. This is kind of a good story about an immediate perception about science being hokey, wrong, stupid, faked, was very, very wrong. And so I was at the stem cell meetings in Toronto in 2005 in the summer, if I have it right, if memory serves. And this was the first time that I heard Yamanaka, the guy who discovered how to make the iPS cells, speak. And I'm not doing research in that exact part of the field. And it was in a session which was the plenary session of the meeting, so the sessions, the part that everybody attends. It was the big audience. It was a big talk, and he started out to give his talk, and it sounded like a crazy idea. And I won't go into the technology, the tech technicalities, but it was a crazy idea. Not only that, it was, I'll make it up, 4 o'clock, and I told my wife, we're going to goof off this afternoon, and I'll be back by 4:30. And, you know, so should I stay for this? Well, I'll stay another minute or two, because this is going to be funny. He's not going to be able to do this, and this is going to be ridiculous. And then all of a sudden, he starts showing the data, and starts showing, oh, my God, it works. And I was either going to go to sleep or going to leave, and instead I was, whoa, let me listen to this. Whoa, this is really a huge, huge change, and it's really fun to be part of those moments. And it was reproducible, and more needed to be done, and all sorts of things. But it's changed the way we think about differentiation. We used to draw those arrows, and they only went in one direction. And now we say they can go back. And as a cancer biologist also, I think about cancer as a reprogramming now. And maybe I should have, but I didn't before that paper. Hmm.
Yeah, those are wonderful moments when you hear something for the first time like that. And I think the crowd is pretty much, you can hear a pin drop because everybody's mouth is open. So as a graduate student, I heard talks like Hal Weintraub talk about MyOD, you know, the first sort of switch, and Walter Gehring talk about Ox genes, and everybody's favorite experiment, making the eyes appear in various places of the PAX-6. So yeah, those are wonderful moments.
Dick, do you have a question?
Kurt, you talked about drawing the arrows forward and drawing the arrows backward. Could the panel comment a little bit on the arrows going sideways now with transdifferentiation?
People, it was a very controversial area, and so people claimed it, and they claimed that, say, cord blood stem cells as the way to, they're easy to get. It's easy to conflate them between embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells. Well, neonatal, that's kind of in between. Maybe they're more pluripotent. And people had claimed that just by throwing them in certain cultures or certain environments, or even just giving them to a mouse, you would get cardiac tissue as a result of that, or something like that. And most people look at those experiments and say, they were probably wrong for one reason or another. They don't usually say fraud, but they just say can't be reproduced. But in the reprogramming now, it's fairly routine to take different types of adult differentiated cells and to, if not directly transdifferentiate them, to have them only go back a little, and then go in another direction.
So the transdifferentiation has a very bad name because of this, these hundreds of papers, and that was very politically motivated. It was the beginning of the century, right? Mm-hmm. So when the argument was you can do everything with adult stem cells, and they can do it, so why do you need embryonic stem cells? And this has many, very high-profile papers all over the place, right? But they're just really poor science, so you might have was different. It was not fraud, but that's very poor science. So what's the difference between two different cell types? It's only epigenetics. There's no genetic difference. So if you don't talk about the immune cells, there's a genetic difference, but there's only epigenetic. So of course you can change the epigenetic state, as you can change the epigenetic state from a skin cell to an iPS cell, right? That's only epigenetic. So of course it works. You have to just do it right. And now people begin to do it right. Using the right transcription factors and the right selection or screening to do this. And of course it works. So there are a couple of examples which are now becoming rather solid. And I think it's not yet robust for many things. And what you get is not necessarily something which you want, but I think it's really in the right direction, and it will work. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
In terms of the different differentiation protocols, are you still mostly relying on transcription factors, or do you think we could be moving towards like microRNAs or other things that we know differ between cells?
Well, all. I mean, this is, I mean, I think what you would like to do is not transcription factors, you can't add easily to cells, right? So you would like to do with the cytokines or with hormones or what have you, right? Which then activate maybe the right pathway. Use small molecules which do activate the transcription factor, you might think. So these are very various approaches. I think the knowledge comes from using transcription factors which are put into the cells with a vector, right? And that's how iPS cells worked, and that's how all the other transdifferentiation experiments worked, all of them. But this is genetically modified cells, and of course, eventually want to do it without genetically modification, right? And then you have to do it non-genetically, and then you have all these different approaches, which are promising and will work at some point, I think.
Well, I want to thank Kurt and Rudolph and George and Nuzwi for coming. I think it was a terrific afternoon and evening, and I hope you appreciate that you got all the news before it was printed. Okay. And I think when we've talked on the phone, many those of us who are graduates think of some way that we can give back to the college, and this is our way. So I hope you appreciate it.
Enjoy that?
Yeah.
It's cool, isn't
great.
It?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Before you go, the college has asked for a photograph of the five of us, and they're all set up. I'll shoot it on our way out.
So I can see how
the stem cells
are a lot of stem cells. So, when you get into your logical, how reliable stem cells are, it seems